session number 10812, Reel 1.
General Foote, Reel 1, can you tell me when you joined the army and why you decided to go in for it, please?
Yes, I joined the army in 19... I went to Sandhurst in 1923, and... The reason I joined there because the army seemed a very pleasant life, and my father was a soldier, and he was out in India for a long time, and thoroughly enjoyed himself out there, and so I decided to join. I was told by my commanding officer, the headmaster of my school, when I hadn't the hope of passing the army exam, but I could take it, and I passed 50th out of about 500, and so I think he was had quite a shock.
Did you find that the training you got at Sandhurst properly fitted you for what was to come later?
Oh, I think so, yes. Of course, it really was training on a general scale for all arms, not just for one particular type of equipment. It catered for the whole of the British Army, all its various formations.
Had you taken a special interest in tanks at that time?
No, I don't think at that time I knew too much about them. But at Sandhurst, of course, one learnt, and one had to decide what branch of the service one wanted to join. And we had a tank officer at Sandhurst who was I liked very much, and he told me all about it, and I decided it was obviously a good thing to go into.
Did you think it was the coming thing?
Oh, yes. Yes, very much so, because in those days, it was obviously going to be of whether it was a trench warfare or whether it was a modern type of warfare. It was obviously going to be a leading thing in the army.
So how exactly did you go into the Royal Tank Corps?
Well, you had to be first of all interviewed by the Colonel Commandant, and which I was duly, and he approved, and so I was gazetted into the Royal Tank Regiment, or Royal Tank Corps, as it was in those days.
When did the Royal Tank Corps become the Royal Tank Regiment?
1938. And I joined in 1925.
What was the state of the Royal Tank Corps in 1925?
Well, the equipment was, of course, still the old First World War tanks. They're very slow, and they carried crew of about six, and they were very much bigger, of course, than what we came to get used to later. They were built for trench warfare, very long.
What were relations like in those days with the cavalry?
Oh, I think actually quite friendly. I mean, the cavalry in those days, of course, was still on horses, and all the ones one met were always got on very well with, no problems.
Did they imagine in the cavalry that they would become tank regiments themselves?
I shouldn't think so. At that time, not when I first joined.
During the interwar period, Did you take much notice of the kind of theoretical debates that were going on about how tanks should be used in warfare?
Oh, yes, yes. Undoubtedly, when you... It's a question of whether the tanks should support infantry in a sort of anti-tank role, or whether they should be formed into divisions of their own, mobile divisions which could dash about the countryside. And there was always schools of thought who thought they ought to be able to look after themselves and be formed up into armoured divisions, and those who thought that the infantry should still have tank support.
Which side did you come down on personally?
Well, I came down personally on the support of the infantry, because our regiment was our regiment at Catterick was really designed for that role.
This was your particular battalion of the RTC, was it?
Yes, battalion, 4th Battalion, Royal Tank Corps in those days.
Who were the particular individuals at that time who had a particular influence on you?
I don't know anyone in particular. One had various commanding officers who one either liked or disliked. But I don't think anyone had any particular interest on one at that time.
How was Little Hartree regarded at that time by people in the RTC?
Well, I think he had his followers, undoubtedly, but I think everyone rather thought he overdid it.
You mean that he promoted his viewpoint too
strongly? Yes. He was very much ready for mobile armour and hadn't really got a lot of use for the infantry side.
One of the interesting duties that you said that you took part in was in the general strike.
Yes.
What was all that about when you were a second lieutenant?
Well, I was stationed then down at Lydd in Kent, and when the general strike started, we were sent up to take over some Peerless armoured cars and to go to London to help support the convoys which was taking food from the London docks to London. And we used to go down there every day and take a number of lorries down with us and bring the food back to London. And at that time we didn't get a lot of people objecting, but occasionally we got chaps who were shouted at one and tried to jump on one's vehicles. But every vehicle had a chap alongside it beside the driver, and another in the rear, and if anyone tried to jump in the lorry, they got hit over the hand, or if it was with a rifle butt, and they didn't do it again.
What kind of food supplies were you taking?
Oh, I don't know. It was just stuff which was coming into the docks at down in the east end of London and bringing it up to a collecting point.
Just in cardboard boxes?
Yes, I mean, we don't know what was in it. Weren't frankly interested in it.
Were your men happy about doing the job, or did you have any
problems? Oh, Lord, yes, yes, yes. It was rather fun at times.
Another duty you had, which might be called internal security, was in India, in Lahore, in the latter part of the 20s.
Yes.
What did that involve for you?
Well, that involved, if there was a riot in Lahore City, and it got out of control of the police, then we would go down to support them. And the only thing we had to carry a magistrate down, and we always put him in the leading car, and when we got to the scene of the riots, he was pushed out so he could read the riot act, which he gabbled through and quickly as he could and jump back in the car, and then we were free to shoot if necessary. And we never really had never had to actually shoot. Always the sight of the armoured cars was enough to quieten the thing down. And so in a way it was quite good fun, but one had to be prepared in case it got ugly. Mm.
What kind of armoured cars were you using then?
Rolls-Royce armoured cars, which were mostly, I suppose, well, the oldest one was 1911 vintage, and the others about 1914 or so.
Did the rioters use missiles against the armoured cars?
No. No, we never had any trouble that way from the rioters. They were much too frightened to throw anything at you. And you didn't want to get a bullet back.
Were you in narrow streets or wide avenues?
Oh, narrow streets, yes. Narrow streets.
So theoretically, you could have been cut off.
Well, theoretically, we could have, yes, but they were much too frightened of the armoured cars to try and attack them in any way.
What were the riots all about?
It were intercommunal riots, Mohammedans versus Hindus and Sikhs, all thrown in together, fighting each other.
And which particular community was forming the crowds?
Oh, it varied. I mean, depending on where the riot was. Mostly Hindu, the actual people who were in the streets. But they were fighting generally the Mohammedans who'd come in, I think, in order to stir them up.
Did you have infantry with you, with those armoured cars?
Not actually with the armoured cars, but the infantry were there, close by.
So it doesn't sound as though it was a frightening experience at all.
Oh, Lord, no. No. It was quite amusing.
Did you ever have to go on other internal security duties in India?
Not in India, no. Only in Lahore.
Can we jump ahead now to the Second World War?
Yes.
And can you tell me what you were doing, first of all, at the Munich crisis in 1938, when we thought that there might be war with Germany?
Yes. Well, I was adjutant of the 4th Royal Tank Regiment then at
Farnborough,
yes.
How seriously did you take the crisis?
Well, we took it serious enough to get prepared in case anything blew up. But luckily, before anything did, it was all called off.
What did your preparations involve?
Well, merely making certain all our equipment was available and easily ready to a quick move, wherever it might be wanted.
What were the 4th RTR equipped with in those days?
Well, we had what are the name of the tanks?
It doesn't matter about the name of the vehicles, but maybe we could talk about the outbreak of war. What do you remember about that?
Well, the outbreak of war, I was at the Staff College as a student in 1939, and as soon as war broke out, we were all summoned and told, and our mobilisation appointments were read out to us, and mine was to be a general staff officer at SD7, the War Office, and within a couple of days off we went to our appointments.
What did an SD7 have to do?
We were responsible for the Royal Armoured Corps side of the army, all the tank equipment and whatnot.
What does SD stand for?
Staff duties.
And what kind of problems did you immediately have to deal with at the War Office?
Well, the main thing was, of course, we were still equipped with tanks with only 2-pounder guns, and the first thing was there was a 6-pounder gun being developed at Woolwich, and the first thing is to try and get that into production as quickly as possible, and we also had to see all the equipment was available and arrange for extra production in the various factories making tanks and things, and generally look after the whole of the personnel side of the Army Corps.
How much knowledge did you have at that time about the German panzers?
Not a great deal. We knew that they'd re-equipped with panzers. We hadn't got any idea of what their capabilities were. We weren't very frightened of them, because in those days, as far as we knew, they only had the very light panzer units, and we weren't particularly frightened of them, because we knew our tanks would be able to take them off, although we were only armed with 2-pounders. It wasn't until the war broke out and the Germans produced their PZ KW 3s and 4s that we realised that they'd had got quite a lot of the new equipment.
Were there any problems in getting the 2-pounder replaced by the 6-pounder?
Well, the 6-pounder was being produced and being tested out, but in 1940, the problem was that if we stopped to convert our factories from making 2-pounders to 6-pounders, would have meant 2 months delay in production, and we just simply couldn't afford it. We wanted all the guns we could get out of the factories, and so Churchill took the decision that we go on producing the 2-pounders until such times as we got sufficient to be given time to convert. And the first 2-pounders didn't appear, the first 6-pounders didn't appear in tanks in the desert until the autumn of 42.
What did the staff at the War Office feel about Churchill's decision?
Well, I'd left by then, so I don't really know, but I think they really would have agreed with it, because the great thing is to have some guns to put in the tanks.
Now, you were telling me earlier, off the record, about the crisis of May 1940...
Yes.
After the Germans swept right across northern France.
Yes.
Can you repeat what you were telling me about the sending of the tank troops to Calais?
Yes. the the War Office were notified that the Germans had broken through to the south and were making for the Calais ports, and we had a brigade in Calais which was only infantry and artillery and no tank equipment at all. And at that time we were moving the 1st Armoured Division from England to France, and one regiment was being taken over each night from Southampton to Cherbourg, and that particular time the battalion which was due to cross that night was the 3rd Tanks, and they were in their lorries being ferried down to Southampton to get on board ships to go to Cherbourg. And so I was told to divert their route from instead of going to Southampton, to go to Dover, where a ship would be available, take them straight across to Calais. But their equipment was already in other ships, and the queue movements at the War Office were arranging for that ship also to be transferred to Calais, and that the two ships should be there the following morning. And so I got into a motor car and drove down to Dover to let the commanding officer know what was happening, with all the latest information, also with all the maps of that area, because I knew you wouldn't have any, and I'd collect these up from the map depot in London. And we motored down, and we motored down through a thunderstorm, quite a lot of lightning and things. And when we got to Calais, we got there just in front of the train which had been diverted. When the commanding officer got out of the train and saw me, he wanted to know what the hell was happening. And we're supposed to be going to Cherbourg. And I said, "You're not, you're going to Calais." And I told him, gave him all the latest information and maps and things, and saw them on board ship. And that was the last we saw them, because 3 days later they were most of them captured, or the remnants got back bit by bit.
I think this commanding officer was called Colonel Keller.
That's right, yes, Colonel Keller.
I think he pointed out to you that all his tank guns were in oil.
Yes, in Greece, all ready for going over. And he said in no uncertain terms that he couldn't possibly get them out under a couple of days, but in actual practice, they got them out in about 24 hours, get them all cleaned up and ready, luckily before the Germans attacked.
I think after this you had a mission to Vauxhall's at Luton.
Yes.
Can you tell me what that involved?
Yes. It was quite obvious that the tanks we were building or designing at that time were built for trench warfare. And they were slow and long, so they could for trench crossing. And quite obviously quite unsuitable for mobile warfare. And so I was sent down to Vauxhall's to see what they could do about it. And we had a talk with their chief engineer and their
draftsman?
Huh?
Draftsman?
No, the boss.
Manager?
Manager, yes. The manager. And he reckoned that they could produce an engine for a new type of tank. And so he said, how long would it take? And he said, from starting to the time we get the first prototype running would be 54 days, I think it was. And they were true to their word. I told them to go ahead and do this. I said, I've got no authority for this, but you do it because we need it badly. And to their honor, they carried this out and did it without any things. And the normal method would have been for us at the War Office to have gone to the Ministry of Supply, to the branch there, and tell them our needs. They would have then contacted the manufacturers to produce whatever was required. But that was taking probably the best part of a week, and we got it done in about 24 hours. And so we were able to save a bit of time that way. Didn't go down practically well with the Ministry of Supply.
And this became the Churchill tank, did it?
This became, yes. When they produced the first prototype, they tried it out and gave a demonstration at what you call it, babe? Well, I just said it.
Luton.
At Luton, yes. And Churchill came down to see it. And he was very pleased and said, yes, go ahead and get into production with it as quick as you can. And so it was called the Churchill tank after that.
Did you meet Churchill at that occasion?
Not on that particular occasion, no, but I saw him on another occasion when I was sitting in my office and the telephone rang, and the voice at the other end said, this is
secretary to the Prime
Minister. Secretary to the Prime Minister said, Prime Minister wants to see you at 4 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. So I said, what about? He said, he'll tell you when you come. So I went along to my boss, the DSD, the Director of Staff Duties, and told him what's happened, and all his reaction was, well, you better go. And so I went down, and we went in, knocked at the door, and we rushed into the room, and there he was in with Professor Lindemann, his advisor, technical advisor. And Churchill turned and said, are you the G2RAC? And I said, yes, sir. And he said, I want you to tell Professor Lindemann here where the German tanks are going to land on our shores and what we can do about it. So I said, very good, sir. Whereupon he went out of the room. And Professor Lindemann, then we went through it, and there were obvious places where they would be likely to come, and obvious places where they couldn't. I mean, they've got to have a beach on which they can land, and they've got to be able to get out.